League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
What are we starting with this week?
Review?
Spotify update.
It's a review.
It is a review.
It may have been a Spotify update, but I forgot what I did last week. So it's a review. So this is a 5-star review from Apple Podcast. You can leave a review at Apple Podcast if you'd like to leave a review. It says, Fab Podcast. Love this podcast so much. I'm currently listening while studying for my 4th year maths exams at uni. The mix of science and comedy is great, and it helps me learn about topics I would never have researched myself. Really recommend this to everyone. You don't even need to know much about science, as it's all explained. Great work, guys.
That's nice.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Yeah, that's
great,
nice.
Great work writing this review, I think. Little round of applause for you. Thank you very much.
High distinction.
Like how we just did a review of that review.
Yeah, maybe we'll do that every single time.
Gets 5 stars.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. 5-star review for the 5-star review.
There we go.
And if you leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we might review your 5-star review.
That's not a show.
Before we start the show, no. Before we start the show, I want to ask everyone that's listening a little question. Everyone that's watching on YouTube, a little question. What is your pet peeve? It's related to the episode, I promise. What is your pet peeve?
Peeve is a dog.
Right. No.
Peeves is a ghost.
No, that's peeves.
Remember
that's
before
plural.
We started the episode when I said I'm going to ask a question, but
we didn't answer it. We just. Tore apart.
I made a joke.
The word
about Luke.
Let us know in the comments what your pet peeve is. Let's start the show.
Let's start the show.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp and Luke Kupfer.
Hello.
Hello there.
This week, I'm going to get on your nerves.
This week?
Always do.
I knew when I wrote that I would receive some flack, but actually, it was quite minimal, so that's fine.
Are we talking about nerves, by any chance?
Well, we're talking about someone that knows something about nerves. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
So kind of, yeah.
Nerves will come up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was almost waiting for you guys to say something. I forgot that this is my part, where I do. I do the part of the show. So have you guys heard of someone called Rita Levi Montalcini?
No.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. She was born in 1909 in April, 22nd, actually, roughly the same birthday as this podcast. Many years before.
Yeah. Well, a few. Yeah.
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 Well, maybe we start this podcast to commemorate her birth. You don't know. And then she died in 2012, almost at the end of the year, 30th of December. And the thing is, she won a Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine. I'm not confused. It's the Nobel Prize for physiology or medicine.
I just didn't research which one. One of them.
One of the two.
I forget.
No, so she won the Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine in 1986. These are just some facts about her. She won that Nobel Prize because of her work with nerve growth factor. That's where nerves come in. We'll get into that in a bit.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, I want to tell you about her life because she's a very interesting person, I think. And so just a few more things about her. These will all become relevant later. She was the first, well, not all of them. She was the first Nobel Prize winner to reach her 100th birthday, which is pretty cool.
That's nice.
Yeah, she lived really old as well. Like I said, 103. So that's many years.
She died really recently then. Not like super recently, but like...
2012.
Yeah, I'd count that as recently. For someone born in 1909, I'd count that as recently.
Yeah, I mean, she lived a long time. She was Jewish. And she was a twin. She had a twin. And her dad was an electrical engineer and a mathematician, and her mother was an artist. So that's just a little bit about her. So essentially, the thing is, right, that she was obviously a young girl.
At some point.
Well, at some point in her life, yeah.
As we all are.
Not in 2012.
Well, I mean, half of us, roughly. Not half of us in this room, just roughly half of us. Yeah, so being a young girl at that time period, it was difficult for her to study science. So she's obviously a very famous scientist, mm-hmm. But it was difficult for her to study science. And here's a little quote from her. It was a very patriarchal society, and I simply resented from early childhood that women were reared in such a way that everything was decided by the man. So as you can see, staunch feminist, fighting for women's rights, specifically her right to do a science. And she had a few different things that she wanted to do. So she wanted to be a writer initially. She wanted to be a philosopher. But then she decided she wasn't logically minded enough, which I don't know if I agree with. I feel like she's got a very logical mind. Or she made some really good leaps in logic.
Yeah.
Which I think you need a logical mind to do.
Yeah.
To some degree. And then her governess died of cancer, so she decided she'd become a doctor.
Aww.
But her dad, who, like as I said, was a kind of scientist himself, was not a big fan of that. He was like, "Nah, you're not being a doctor."
Of course,
this is like a classic superhero origin story.
She is kind of like a superhero. I'm not gonna lie. Like you could make a movie about her life, or actually, you could make a streaming series about her life, The Crown. Yeah. Show. Mm. I would watch that.
The structure is there already. It's so good.
It is. So the thing is that her dad, obviously, as I said, did not want her to become a scientist. So it was sort of a mission of convincing him. So she had to go to a girls' high school, where essentially once you leave high school, you then get married. You don't go to university or whatever. Not like immediately. Not like the graduation ceremony is like The Bachelor. Although
you find out who your husband is, that would be tragic.
So yeah, this is the thing. She wanted to be a scientist. She had to convince her dad. She left high school, and then it took her 3 years until her dad was like, "Fine, you can go to university." Although what's shocking to me is that she was 21, right? Like she's fully an adult at that point. They didn't know she was going to live 100 years. Like she's lived a fair amount of like her expected lifetime.
Yeah,
she's an adult. Let her do what she wants.
Yeah,
you know, before she turns 21. So she went to the Turin School of Medicine when she was 21, as I said, and she studied under a man named Levy, who is not related to her at all.
Have we talked about Levy before? That seems like a familiar name.
Maybe he might have come up, but her name is Levy Montalcini, so that might be where. It sounds familiar.
Maybe.
I mentioned it like 5 minutes ago.
Okay.
Yeah. no, but this Levy is not related to her at all. The first thing I read on that didn't say they weren't related. I was very confused. I thought, maybe she got married to him. She never got married.
Oh, but so, wouldn't that mean she's called Levy Levy?
No. No, I thought the Levy Montalcini in her name was a double barrel surname because she seemed like the kind of person who wouldn't want to take her husband's name. So she became Levy Montalcini. But that's not what happened at all.
Okay.
Oh. No, I need to be like exceedingly clear. This man named Levy, just another guy who's also called Levy.
That's interesting.
Just a little coincidence. So, so his name was Giuseppe Levy. She worked under him for quite a while. I say quite a while. Actually not that long. You'll see why. He taught her how to essentially, there was this technique with using silver and nerve cells wherein you use silver to stain nerve cells and then you can see them under a microscope, like sort of individually.
Yeah.
Whereas you wouldn't be able to otherwise. Essentially this would be quite important in her career. As I said, she went to medical school. She worked with Levy, and then she graduated in 1936. You might be aware that something is coming up in history. A big history thing is coming up soon. So she graduated medical school in 1936, and then she started training in neurology and psychiatry because she didn't know what she wanted to do, whether she wanted to actually go into practice medicine or sort of go into research of neurobiology. And so she continued. She continued with the sort of silver staining technique that I told you about. She was using that on the nerves of chicken embryos, and she did that until 1938. At which point, in 1938, Mussolini had some race laws that meant that Jews weren't allowed to be scientists. Being a Jew, she was not allowed to be a scientist.
Another man telling her not to be a scientist.
It never stopped.
First her father, second Mussolini.
I mean, look, if you think she was going to listen to Mussolini, you're wrong. No, so... So she moved, essentially...
No one listens to Mussolini.
No, I think a lot of people... That was the issue.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. She left, so Jewish people were like sort of forced out of universities all over the country. And not just universities, like so many. They were forced out of a lot of places all over the country. Levy as well. He was made to leave. And so essentially her family moved to Brussels in 1939. But before that, what she'd done was she set up a laboratory in her bedroom. She made equipment out of like sewing needles and stuff. Like,
oh, wow.
it was all this homemade stuff that she literally set up a lab, like a makeshift lab in her bedroom so that she could continue her work. And then they were forced to move to Brussels, in 1939 in March. And so she continued doing this. She's continued neurology research, neurological research, initially from her bedroom, but in Brussels, she went to a neurological institute. She was still in contact with Levy, who was sort of living nearby at that time. He had started up this sort of tissue culture center.
Yeah.
So he was also continuing his work while she was continuing her work. Germany went to invade Belgium towards the end of 1939. So she left and went back to Italy. It said like a lot of her career at this point was basically bouncing around to avoid fascism, which just it's honestly amazing to me that like this is the thing that I really like about her is that she continued to do like groundbreaking work despite the fact that she there was literally fascism in her
everything was going wrong in the world all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Like she could have like
can't avoid it.
At any point she could have just given in and been like, you know what, yeah, I can't fight this anymore. I'm not going to do science. But no, she said, no, Dad, no Mussolini, no Hitler. I am going to do science all I want.
What a legend.
Fascism can't stop me.
No, like actually, it literally cannot. So she got a microscope. She made a sort of incubator out of stuff that she found. And like I said, she made surgical sort of instruments from sewing needles so that she could like, you know, sort of work with the embryos that she was using.
Yeah.
I think this was, I heard this as well, that she was just buying fertilized chicken eggs. And that was how she was getting the embryos. She was like literally everything that she had, she was just able to get herself, which is really cool. And so she wanted to study how, nerve cells sort of left the spinal cord and got into the organs that they were supposed to get into, the sort of muscles, right? And there was this article by a man named Victor Hamburger, who was working in the US. There was an article. Yes?
Nothing?
No.
I'm just wondering if he invented the hamburger.
No.
It would make sense. It would make sense.
Well, it's just such a specific name. I never knew that was a name.
I mean, hamburgers have
their
name.
What came first, Victor Hamburger or the hamburger?
The hamburger, probably. It's from Hamburg, I think, isn't it not?
Oh. So he's from Hamburg too, like the hamburger. He's a hamburger?
He is a hamburger.
It's a hamburger, yeah.
I mean, I don't think he's necessarily directly from Hamburger.
In the way that in the way that there are Londoners and stuff. He was a hamburger.
Yeah. I
mean, so his family, eventually he's a hamburger.
Sure. So essentially, what hamburger was doing was looking into how limbs sort of essentially how limbs worked with the central nervous system, how this in the sort of formation of the central nervous system. We could get really complex about it, but I feel like you guys don't want me to get very complex about it because it's
no, I do.
Okay, well, that's
go on then.
That's a one-to-one Luke, I'm not. No, I could get a little bit more in depth, right? Essentially, he was taking the wings out of chicken embryos, and he noticed that there were like there are these sort of nerve fibers, these sort of bundles of nerves that are outside the central nervous system. Mm. He noticed that essentially those would get smaller if you were to remove the wings.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I don't want to get too into it, but essentially he noticed, like, that if you remove limbs, then there are these bundles of nerves outside the central nervous system that, like, sort of don't grow. They're smaller.
Like they retreat.
Ah. Not necessarily they retreat. They don't grow bigger. They don't retreat. They just get smaller.
So he was chopping off baby bird wings.
No, embryos. So they'd be inside an egg.
He was chopping off embryo bird wings and then seeing what happened to the central nervous system.
Kind of, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, we're each to their own.
Well, so it's not so much, it's the, it's, so it was looking at the, he was looking at the spinal ganglia. Like I said, these are kind of like, these are kind of like bundles of nerves that sit sort of outside of the central nervous system. So it's not actually like within the central nervous system, it's like the sort of bundles that sit outside of it. And essentially, so from his experiments, he had this idea, he had this hypothesis, one could say, that the limbs sort of, that limbs sent signals, and that then made the sort of the nerve cells, or the cells that would become nerve cells, sort of like turn into actual nerve cells, right? So he essentially thought that the limbs would send a signal and make the sort of undifferentiated nerve cells become nerve cells, and also then made the nerve cells get into whatever they want to get into, right? So like if that was the, if it was like the muscle cells of the limb, right? So that's essentially what his idea was, that the limb, right, the wing would send a signal to the cells that were going to become nerve cells, saying become nerve cells and also come here.
Ah.
Right.
We should have gone with Champ's vote.
Well, I tried. So Levi Montalcini, she did the experiment again, but then she did this silver staining thing that I told you about. See, it's come back. It's a little bit of foreshadowing. So she did the silver staining technique, and that meant that she was able to actually look at what was happening to the nerves. And so essentially, she had a closer look at what was going on with these nerves, right? So she had the same observation as Hamburger, that that if you were to remove the wings, you'd have like the sort of spinal ganglia, they would reduce, right? But she also noticed that something maybe a little bit different. Well, she noticed something a bit more, right? That even if you removed the limb, the nerve cells would continue to sort of essentially divide and become, they would continue to become more nerve cells, but then died after they got to the stump.
Oh.
Of the sort of of where you pulled off the wing.
Ah.
Right? So it's not just like, it's not like like you pull off the wing and it stops. You pull off the wing and the nerve cells grow to the stump and then they die.
And then stop.
Yeah.
So they don't like meet any friends there. And so they go, well, there's nothing here. I will now
die.
It's
the end of the line.
No. I think I already told you what she discovered,
sure,
as well.
I just mean there's no wing going, come over here. And so they just go like, okay.
Well, the thing is that Hamburger didn't necessarily have the right idea. That's just what his hypothesis was.
Right?
So
wow, the plot thickens.
Oh boy, is this so thick. You could cut
twists and turns all the way.
You could cut this plot with a knife. It's so thick. She essentially said, Levi Montalcini said, that the reason that the nerve cells died was because there was something that was supposed to be there that wasn't there, right? It was some kind of factor that, influenced the growth of nerves. A nerve growth factor, one could say.
What is a factor? Sorry.
If we talk about growth factors. I could get into it later once I get to our actual experiments, but we talk about growth factors in biology. It's essentially something that stimulates the growth of something else.
Is it a chemical?
It's a chemical, yeah. I'll get into it'll be more relevant later, right?
Cool.
The thing is that she thought that essentially instead of it being the the nerve cells, like, essentially not getting all the stuff they need to sort of like become more nerve cells, that the reason that they weren't, the reason that they were shrinking was because of like degeneration, right? Because they didn't have this, they didn't have this thing telling them to grow, essentially, mm-hmm. or promoting their growth. Whereas, yeah, Hamburger had a kind of slightly different idea. That's the thing, because they didn't, because these ganglia didn't essentially immediately just die when the limb was taken off. She was like, okay, there must be something that is like promoting or influencing that growth. Mm. So that's essentially like the whole idea was that it's not something that sort of induces growth. It's something that promotes growth. Right. And so that was kind of the start of her, that was kind of the start of her research. That was kind of like the start of her like sort of road to the Nobel Prize, you could say. And then in 1942, because the World War II is still happening, there was bombing where she was living. So she had to go to the countryside and she would cycle to a farm to buy fertilized eggs. And apparently I read this as well, that she could just eat the eggs when she was finished like experimenting on them, supposedly. This is what I read, but I'm not sure if that's like, I'm not sure if you would actually do that.
Bargain.
Well, there was a chat in another podcast, I think last week, No Such Thing as a Fish, that was talking about there being certain areas of the world where a fertilized egg is a delicacy in some countries. Mm. So they actually eat that like as a frequent like thing that they really enjoy, as like a freshly fertilized egg.
God. Not just a chicken period isn't good enough. It's no. Got to be a little potential chicken
baby. It
has baby.
To be developing.
Mm, yeah, give that.
Enhances the taste.
You just really, really want that like cockerel sperm in there. It just...
oh, curry.
What? What?
You took it there.
Egg plus sperm. Delicious.
Yeah. I mean, egg on its own. Blech. Add some sperm in there. Yum. Mm. That's why I always add sperm to my omelets.
It's for the protein.
But it's not cockerel sperm, curry.
No. Well, no. It's from a certain kind of
curry. Stop it. Stop yourself.
I cannot.
No. Sci guys after dark.
I'm so sorry.
So Italy then switched. They stopped siding with the fascists and decided to be with the Allies in 1943.
How good of them.
Well, yeah. You know,
eventually.
I mean, I think my side might be losing. Mm. Better switch to the good guys.
Are we the baddies?
Oh, come on. I feel like you must know you're the baddies from the start, right? There's no way you could be in World War II and be like, who is in the right here? Well, actually, no. I mean,
no, because they had all this rubbish, like fake science to back up their beliefs, didn't they?
I suppose they did. And I was going to say also, as we spoke about in our eugenics episode, Winston Churchill was a eugenicist. He was like in the same way that Hitler was a eugenicist. Mm-hmm. Winston Churchill was a member of the Eugenicist Society or whatever, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Right?
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe it was.
And eugenics was a British Hitler? Invention.
Yeah. Oh. Well, to be fair, the Americans.
Was a German invention.
The Americans took eugenics. The Americans took eugenics and did, like, I was going to say did a good job with it. That's not the best way to describe it. Did they do some work on it. And then the Germans were like, well, the Nazis.
Boy, did they give it a growth factor.
No, the Nazis were then like, wow, these Americans really have got some good stuff going on there with that eugenics stuff. Boy, howdy, what if we try it?
We should try it.
But they said it all in German, obviously.
Boy, howdy. How does that translate into German?
Junge, howdy.
They said howdy with an American accent.
Of course they do. And then also, apparently, some stuff the Americans did. This is to black people, by the way. White Americans did to black people. If it's not obvious.
Yeah.
Apparently, some of the stuff they did there was too bad even for the Nazis. They were like, ooh, that's a bit harsh. Let's just...
Bearing in mind, the Nazis had, like, camps where they, like, what did they do to people? Oh, it was horrible. Yeah. They had all these horrible experiments and stuff.
I wouldn't even really call them experiments as much as just abject torture.
Yes.
Right? And this was... Essentially, it was Jim Crow laws that the Nazis were pinching from pinching from the Americans and applying them to Jews.
I'll take that.
Yeah. Ooh.
Snatch.
Thank you very much. And then the Americans came in and were like,
how dare you steal that?
That's don't hard. Steal our stuff. Anyway, have a bomb. There you go. Yeah. And have another one. Oh, that's a war crime, you say? We promise we won't do it again. Don't like that. Anyway, let's just move. World War II annoys me.
Yeah.
Like, a lot. Let's move on.
Gets on my nerves.
So, yeah, in 1943, Italy switched sides to fight with the Allies, and Hitler's troops went into northern Italy. But after all that business with World War II, she returned to Italy. Levi Montalcini returned to Italy, and she started working as Levi's assistant again. But I didn't mention this. While she was working in her like homemade laboratory for quite a few years, Levi came and like became her assistant, which is incredible, right? She was a recently graduated she recently graduated as a med student, like she just graduated, and like this very fairly well respected, like fairly well experienced doctor came and was her assistant, which just doesn't happen. That's not something that happens. Like, her first assistant was her previous mentor. So she went back to work as his assistant. And apparently it was a little bit like a demotion for her. She was like, I can't really be doing this. I've got my own stuff I want to do. So luckily in 1946, in summer, she got a letter from none other than Professor Victor Hamburger. Look at that. All these characters coming to... This is what I'm saying. Wow. This would be a brilliant series,
wouldn't it? This is a plot. It's just every... Like, the thing in the first act comes back in the third act. It's brilliant.
It's kind of like...
This is what the MCU feels like.
Show a hamburger in act one if you're not going to use it in act four.
Chekhov's hamburger.
I was going to say, this is kind of like... It's kind of like Queen's Gambit, right? Yeah. You know, where they've got... Oh, they've got, like... You've got... what's his name? Thomas Brody Sangster. Oh, he's coming up. But then he comes back at the end. Ooh. Victor Hamburger is Thomas Brody Sangster, I think.
That's nice.
I think that's who should play him.
I haven't seen it.
You've not seen it?
No.
Oh, you watched me watch it.
I think we talked about this last week.
We talked about this last week. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very relevant show.
Yeah.
Luke clearly hasn't seen it either.
I've seen The Queen's Gambit.
Oh.
Okay.
It's a wonderful
show. You would have understood then.
Yeah, he would have understood. Yeah.
Sorry, I was checking that my Chekhov's gun reference was accurate. It was.
Yeah. <that's>, although, interestingly, people like get Chekhov's gun wrong. Not wrong. There's like two ways of interpreting it in that, like, there's the way one, which is like, if you're going to put it in the first act, you need to use it in the third act or use it by the third act. But other people do it in a more sort of like watching the thing way, whereas like, well, if they introduce this thing, then it's going to come back later. There's two ways of viewing it.
And then it's so frustrating when it doesn't. If you spot something that's like, that's clearly a Chekhov's gun, and then it just never gets used. It's like, what? Why was that there?
Why did you have it?
It does frustrate me. But also, I think it could be, because you've got that expectation, it can be interesting to play on that by being like, here's something that might happen, and then it doesn't.
Have some good red herring.
Yeah.
That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're pointing at the audience and going, you're the problem.
But then you can red herring on a red herring, or you could like bring it back. It's like
set it up as if it's going to be a red herring.
Yeah.
But then it turns out to be the gun.
Genius.
Sam.
Chekhov's red herring.
There it is.
Don't bring it up if you're...
Don't bring it up if you're going to pretend you brought it up as a red herring and then you actually use it. And then you can red herring.
Funnily enough, Ryan Johnson actually listened to this episode of the podcast before writing Knives Out.
Yeah.
He traveled back in time, wrote it after listening to this.
And he's going to take it with him into Knives Out 2 and 3.
He's a patron. He gets the episodes out. Thanks, Ryan Johnson.
You're welcome for your career, Ryan.
Well done on making the best Star Wars movie. There, that'll get some comments.
Oh. Why would you say something so controversial yet so true?
Right?
Yeah.
So, back to Levi Montalcini. So, she was invited by Professor Victor Hamburger to come and work with him. And she was like, okay, cool. That was in St. Louis, yeah, in the U.S. So he invited her for just one semester, but she ended up staying in the U.S. for, it was continuing to sort of do research in the U.S. for 30 years. So it was a very long semester. So essentially they
held back a bit.
kept in fourth grade.
God, if you don't get this semester right, Levy, we cannot know. So she stayed there for a long time. But so they went back to do the initial experiments, because the reason he invited her over was because he'd read some of the papers that she'd published doing similar experiments to her. And this is something that I think that people don't necessarily think that scientists do. A big part of your job as a scientist is to stay aware of what's going on in your field. So it involves a lot of reading other people's stuff along with doing your own work. So he basically read her papers that she published, and he was like, wow, she good. Come work with me, please. So she went on over. They continued doing the sort of limb pulling and seeing what was happening in the little sort of developing wing buds of chicken embryos. They found out that actually the if you were to take a limb off, right, the ganglia related to the limb, remember the ganglia is a sort of little bundle of nerve fibers outside of the central nervous system. The limb ganglia, if you were to pull off a limb, they would like sort of degenerate. But then if you were to put on another limb, you just graft a little one on there, they start sort of growing again.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so long as you pop a limb on there, you're all good, son.
Like a Lego man.
Wait, is that during the life or whilst it's still a fetus?
They're doing all of these studies on embryos.
Okay, yeah. So that doesn't happen if you just like graft an arm onto someone. I know that it doesn't,
to that extent.
But I mean that the ganglia could start growing towards it. I don't know.
I mean,
even if it doesn't work.
Well, it depends. I mean, I know if you cut off a finger and you put the finger back on, you can save the finger and have some kind of use of it.
And they find how to rewire. It's amazing. It all rewires itself.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Apparently, I don't know what the biggest thing you could do it with, but I think... can you do it with a hand? That must be... That'd be wild. I was actually thinking about this the other day, completely separate to this. I was thinking about whether... No, it was someone's foot, I think. No, it was someone's hand. Someone on TikTok, they lost their hand. They found it again, but it wasn't attached to their body anymore.
that is how you lose it. Yeah, yeah.
Apparently, from a website called the American Society for Surgery of the Hand, there is arm, hand, and finger replantation. So you've got arm, hand, and finger replantation. And it's defined as successful if some of the abilities, like some feeling, some movement, comes back.
Oh yeah, bear in mind, I'm not saying that you can chop off a hand and then put it back on and immediately be able to
play the piano,
good as gold,
play the piano, play the fiddle, do a Rubik's cube. Like you'll probably be a little bit like not great, but you've still got a hand there.
Yeah,
which is, you know,
better than no hand.
A hand in the hand is worth two in the bush, right?
Hand on the arm,
hand on the arm,
that's wise it. Man once said
in the bin.
That was a really good, that was some great teamwork there. I laid the groundwork. I was Victor Hamburger here, and Luke, my Levy Montalcini, came
I
in.
I read your work in the journal Science, and I thought, I can build upon this work. Science.
So back to Levy Montalcini. She was working with Victor Hamburger for a while, but after a little bit, while she was doing those experiments, someone came back there, a man named Elmer Boecker, should have read this before, B-U-E-K-E-R. That's a name that is difficult to pronounce. He's probably dead by now anyway, so it should be fine. Yeah. Anyway, Elmer came back. He was a graduate student, and he was trying to see if you could get any sort of fast-growing tissue to sort of promote the growth of nerves, because... I mean, like a fast-growing tissue being like tumor cells, right?
Yeah,
because they grow fast as well. So he was trying to see if any fast-growing tissue could make nerve fibers like sort of come towards them in the same way that sort of developing limbs do. Mm-hmm. So he basically got some mouse tumor, like a mouse sarcoma, and grafted it. He just put it onto a chicken embryo, and he found that basically the nerve fibers grew towards the tumor.
Oh, well. Wow.
So the tumor also promoted the growth of the nerve fibers. In fact, there was more nerve fibers on the tumor than on the sort of like limb bud, essentially. So like the tumor would make more nerve cells grow than the limb would. Mm-hmm. And his idea for this was essentially that there was a greater surface area of the tumor, so that it meant that more nerves could come up to that. We'll get into like the sort of the actual facts of it in a bit. So Levi Montalcini didn't think that this idea was quite right. She didn't think that it was just the surface area, because she also noticed that the nerve cells that were growing into the tumor were just growing all over the place, right? If nerve cells are growing into the limbs, they're very ordered. They're in a way that there is a set way of kind of them growing in, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with the tumor, they were just like all over the shop.
Going all over the place.
Like a tumor, really.
Yeah.
Undirected growth.
Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly it, yeah. And she essentially got the idea that the tumor tissue was releasing, like I said, a factor that promoted the growth of nerves, a nerve growth factor. Literally, essentially, it was releasing some kind of chemical signal that made the nerves go, boys, it's time to get growing. let's grow, girls. So that was her idea. And so she continued to work on that. She continued to work on that for a bit. She did the experiment again. And this time again used the silver staining technique that we spoke about. Man, this silver staining technique is kind of like a character.
Keeps coming back, yeah.
I think Bryan Cranston should play the silver staining technique in the series. Definitely. Once again, this happens a lot in science, but once again, she took a man's findings and she added to them, made them a little bit better. Mm-hmm. She kind of confirmed that essentially, but also found that the nerves that were going into the tumor, they didn't make connections with the cells of the tumor, which would normally happen when cells like get into, it's called innervating, like when cells get into when nerves get into like sort of normal tissues, right? So normally when nerves grow into tissues, they'll like get into contact with the cells properly. Mm-hmm. But with the tumor, that just was not happening.
So what did they do? They just got to the tumor and then kept growing all over the place.
Yeah, there was just not ordered growth. It was like, yeah, essentially the tumor was just making the nerves grow towards the tumor, but not really telling them what to do after that.
Right.
And the thing is that she also noticed that even the tissues that were far away from the tumor got tons and tons of nerves in them. Like there were so many nerves growing in them even before, like way before that would happen with like the control. So when you use the tumor, right, like cells even far away from the tumor would get tons of nerves around them. Like areas even far away from the tumor would get tons of nerves growing. Whereas if you did it with just say, a normal embryo, that would take way longer for those areas to grow a bunch of nerves. And the thing is that even the nerves even grew into some of the blood vessels, right? Some of the like sort of like veins and arteries that were supporting the tumor. Like the nerves would
damage the tumor.
No.
Would that not damage it if they grew into the blood vessels?
That's not, well, I mean, it's not to damage the tumor. It was, they were
just, no, not too damaged, but the effect would be damaging, would it not?
I mean, it could be, but so long as the blood vessels still remain functional.
Yeah.
That wasn't really the sort of the point of the experiment. The point here, the thing to take away from this is that the thing that is making the nerves grow, this like nerve growth factor, right, must be able to diffuse. It gets secreted from the tumor and it's able to diffuse to other areas, and it could be carried by the blood because that's why it's growing into these sort of blood vessels, right? Mm. And yeah, she wanted to sort of test this idea. And essentially, what she did was she took the tumor and she put it onto like this sort of like she put onto the sort of membrane that the chicken embryo sort of that covers the chicken embryo. So essentially it had like the same blood supply, but it wasn't sort of like directly connected with the sort of tissues of the embryo. So what that meant is that if it was something that could diffuse, it could diffuse across this membrane, but the tumor wouldn't have direct contact. So it did diffuse across the membrane. It did promote the growth of a nerve cell. So she had basically proven that that there was some diffusible chemical of some sort or substance of some sort that was promoting the growth of nerves. And so she realized that actually it would be better for her to start working on like not just chicken embryos in sort of eggs in vivo, but to start working on basically in vitro cultures, which we've spoken about before, basically doing it in test tubes, right? So to do that, to learn this sort of technique, she had to go to Brazil. And so this is a story that you hear a lot of people telling about her. She took two mice that had cancer, popped them in her handbag, or popped them in her pocket, got on a plane to Brazil, and
broke some laws in the process, I'm sure.
It's not a normal story.
Yeah, well, it says concealed.
Put a finger down.
Put a finger down, yeah. It says concealed in her handbag, so I think she genuinely just like popped a couple mice in her handbag, hid them, and I mean, bear in mind, this was in like the 50s. You could smoke on planes in the 50s. You could do what you want. You could take any amount of liquids you wanted on a plane in the 50s.
Oh,
you could
imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people
taking a keg on a plane. It's just my hand luggage.
An entire water cooler.
Well, yeah. I mean, how else are you going to sexually harass all of the flight attendants if you don't have a keg? That was normal and expected in the 50s. Genuinely.
That's horrible.
It's horrible. Yeah. The world we live in is not very good. Aww. But anyway, she nicked some mice. Well, she didn't steal some mice. She took some mice on a plane, hid them, and just flew to Brazil because that's the kind of woman she was. Nothing stops her from doing what she wants to do. So
good
she
science.
Yeah, so she had a friend there, Hertha Meyer, who was also a student of Levy. Essentially, she learned the technique there to grow nerves, to basically work in test tubes with what she was doing. Basically, through all of this, she sort of found a way to continue her work sort of more effectively. She also met a man named Stanley Cohen when she got back to St. Louis. He had joined the lab that she was previously working in. So when she got back there, Stanley Cohen was working there, and he was actually the person that ended up sharing the Nobel Prize with her. So they were working together. They spent 6 years trying to properly identify the nerve growth factor thing that they were looking at, the thing that was being released by the tumor. And you got to remember at this point, no one in the, like all the stuff she was saying about this nerve growth factor and stuff, the science community didn't believe her. Right, they were like staunchly against her. They were like, "This is not even science. This is just silly." Because at the time, growth factors just were not an accepted thing. Like, it's crazy to think that we know about growth factors now. Like it's something that's. I mean, if you're learning science, it's taught as fact, obviously, right? But like 70 years ago, no idea. Genuinely, no one, the broader community just did not believe it.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yes.
Has science as a sort of area of study got better at... Because you've got this situation where she's saying something that's not anything like the accepted science, right? And so scientists are going, this is crazy what you're saying. This is not true. And are dismissing it. And obviously you've got to have a certain amount of dismissal because there are also things that will be suggested that aren't true and turn out to be not true. And you kind of wanted some skepticism for those things. Otherwise you would have gone down the wrong path. But... has science got any better at being open to possibilities that are outside of the current paradigm than they were during sort of this era?
Yeah, so I think that I think there are a few factors that sort of affect that. I think one, the sort of accessibility of scientific information. I think that's definitely gotten better, especially with the internet. So you can you can look see what is going on in your field. It's be far easier than it would have been sort of 70 years ago. Also, I feel like techniques have improved. So it is, I think I would probably say it's easier to prove that you're sort of not correct or correct on something because techniques have gotten much more precise, right? So if you want to test for, as we'll see, when they were looking at for nerve, this sort of, this nerve growth factor, they had to do a lot of steps to basically kind of get down to what it actually was, right? To figure out exactly what it was. Whereas nowadays, with our modern techniques, that process would be a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if people are necessarily more open to change, but I think it is far. I think it's probably far easier to be convince people of sort of convince people of the validity of what you're saying, right? Because it's more easy for people to access that information and therefore sort of test what you're saying themselves. And also, you can be much more specific in your testing. So any claim that you make can be far more specific. So I think overall, it probably is easier to sort of bring in things from outside of that paradigm.
Cool.
Yeah. So essentially, they spent ages trying to find out what was going on with this nerve factor. They wanted to figure out what it was, whether it was a nucleic acid or whether it was a sort of protein. And so someone suggested, Arthur Kornberg suggested, that they use snake venom. Because snake venom essentially would degrade nucleic acid. So if it degraded it, it would be a nucleic acid. If it didn't degrade it, it would be a protein. Now, the thing is that the snake venom didn't destroy it. So it was a protein. But also the snake venom increased the effect of the sort of nerve growth. In fact, if you were to use snake venom on its own, it would cause the nerves to grow way more than the tumor extract.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, so snake venom is a growth agent?
Well, there was
a growth factor.
There was a growth factor in snake venom, essentially.
Wow, plot twist.
Yeah, which is like crazy. But people were really skeptical about this, right? And when they said snake venom and also mouse saliva, or stuff from the salivary glands of mice, also have a lot of this factor in them because they also promote nerves. People were like, this is silly. Snake venom, okay, right, you're saying tumors, snake venom, mouse spit, all of this makes nerves grow?
It's quiet. Everywhere.
Shush. This magic little protein that does, what are you talking about? They were right. Yeah, so the thing is, like, you got to remember, right? At this time, you're trying to say that there's this thing that can dissolve, right? Mm-hmm. Which diffuses from sort of tissue to tissue, and then really, really strongly affects this one specific thing that nerves do. That was a lot for people to believe at the time. So they weren't so hot on believing that. And I think the sort of more people believed it when Cohen, a man, discovered another factor, which he called epidermal growth factor. And in 1959, Levi Montalcini, she and Cohen, they together developed something that could basically sort of stop nerve growth factor from working. So essentially, nerve growth factor, it's a protein that stimulates the sort of growth of nerves, essentially. It's fairly straightforward. And growth factors, again, are just are essentially just sort of proteins, chemicals that stimulate the growth of whatever. So it was fully proven, right? Fully, like, sort of the sort of issue was put to rest pretty much entirely in 1971 when Levi Montalcini's PhD student Ruth Hoag Angeletti basically used an automated protein sequencer to figure out the sequence of this nerve growth factor protein. And apparently Rita Levi Montalcini didn't put her name on the paper, which people would normally do, because she was it's just the kind of thing that she did. She was like, no, I'm not gonna put my, you take this one, my PhD student, which is lovely. And then she started to split her time between Italy, between Rome and the US. And in 1986, they were awarded the Nobel Prize. Apparently, when she got the news, she was reading a book. She was reading Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun. Quote from her right now. At the moment I was finding out about the criminal, they told me that I was awarded the Nobel. So I was happy about it, but I wanted much more to... I'll try that again. We can keep this all in. Here's the quote, not butchered. At the moment I was finding out about the criminal, they told me that I was awarded the Nobel. So I was very happy about it, but I wanted much more to know the ending of the story. And she's got a little note written on the second to last page saying, call from Stockholm. because she was reading the book. She got a call from Stockholm. She wrote a little note in the book. So she's like, she's got that little note there, or she had. She doesn't have anything now. She's a corpse.
That reminds me of the story where someone had won the Nobel Prize and like they couldn't get in touch with them. And they, I think you might have told me that, about this, Corey. I can't remember. There was someone who won a Nobel Prize, but they didn't like have a phone or have any kind of way of contacting them. And so they had to call like their brother and then like get the message to them. And then, yeah, I can't. Do you? Is this a story you told me, Corey?
Might have been a story that we covered in Sci Guys. Maybe.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of familiar. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure though.
I don't know. Well, that was a great story, wasn't it?
It was a really good one. Yeah. So essentially, they got the Nobel Prize. Essentially for their work on nerve growth factor. This is the thing. So Bill Mobley, who was the chair of the Department of Neurosciences at the University of California, the San Diego School of Medicine. God, that's a mouthful. A neuroscientist said, "Discovery of NGF really changed the world in which we live, because now we know that cells talk to other cells and they use soluble factors. It was hugely important." And then she continued to work on after that. She published 21, she published over 20 books. She worked basically until she died. She had this brain research institute in Italy, the European Brain Research Institute. And the thing is, this is just another couple stories before we wrap up. She was great, right? She, obviously, people did not believe her. When she was talking about nerve growth factor at the start, and then they did believe her, and she was not happy with people for quite a while, right?
You didn't believe me.
Well, you wouldn't, like obviously she would have faced a lot of sexism and skepticism. Yeah. And so she was like, yeah, I was right. And then when a bunch of people started to like come into the field after it became like established as, oh, this is something that's real, she was like, hold on, get lost. This is mine. And you said you said it wasn't real, and now you're coming in here. You stay away. This is my whole thing. Apparently she fell out with a lot of people that that got into the NGF field. And there's this story that I've got from a man named Bradshaw. There was a sort of a meeting or a sort of like or is it from Bradshaw? I think this is a man named Green. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. There's this story I've got where essentially I think this sort of meeting or this presentation, someone did their presentation and they said, "Are there any questions?" And she put her hand up, and she started talking. He realized this wasn't a question, and as she was talking, little by little, she
was an explanation.
No, she started walking up to the podium, and then you realize that essentially what she was doing was not asking a question, but giving like this really like extended statement about NGF nerve growth factor and the history of like its discovery. So like this person had basically done the presentation. "Are there any questions?" She was like, "Yes, me. Well, actually, you see, I discovered this back then. This is the history."
Wow! That.
And like, she what took, a flex. Yeah. She went,
"I have a little question."
Just a little
question.
Got up, walked to the microphone, took it. This guy said he was like, "Well, I couldn't really do more. I couldn't do anything, but just step away and just let her finish." Right? She standing next to the microphone. What can I do? Give her the microphone and just wait for her to be finished. And I love that about her. She, as a woman in a world where she was held back, particularly in her field, she was like, "Nah, I know what I'm doing. I'm the best at this. You'll all listen to me.
My time to be the lecturer now."
"Oh, it's very cute of you to tell me about your experiments. You know who discovered this?"
She should have then been like, turned to the presenter and been like, "Do you have any questions for me?"
Power move. That's an absolute power move. By the early 80s, she started to like sort of, she started to just sort of, I mean, get on good terms with everyone again, right? Sort of like, you know, be like, "Oh, bygones are bygones, you know, well, I was gonna say beat the meat, that's not what it is. It's what's the word for when you can wipe the slate clean?
You can do that.
Squash your beef. That's
hash it. Out.
Squash your beef. Not yeah. beat the meat. Squash the beef.
Squash your beef.
Yeah, squash
beat
your beef.
Oh. Don't beat the meat.
No. Okay. Don't
it's
beat
ungodly.
The meat.
Unless you want to fertilize your omelet, then otherwise it's probably better to beat the meat. It's a callback. It's Chekhov's. It's Chekhov's cum omelet.
There it is.
Oh. Cumlet.
Chekhov's sperm. Oh.
I do not want to know about Chekhov's sperm. Thank you very much. That is an episode of Star Trek I would very much like to avoid.
Ryan, don't get any ideas.
Corey forcing the image of him masturbating into a frying pan on all of us and the audience. I don't want to know about Chekhov's sperm. All right, good for you, man.
Just you wait. The villain of Knives Out 2 is going to be like
one giant sperm.
I mean, the murder is going to be done by someone like ejaculating into an omelet or something. I promise you. That's how it's going to go. Ryan's listening. He knows. So
he gets all his best ideas from us.
How funny would it be, right? Because this is the thing. You never know who's listening to your podcast. How funny would it be if Ryan Johnson actually is listening to this podcast at some point?
We should tweet it at him.
No.
Be like,
no.
Listen to this one.
No. Hey, Ryan, listen to this podcast. It's really great. Starts talking about coming into an omelet. No.
Hey, remember when we gave Ryan Johnson his career? You're welcome.
Anyway, so there's she was pretty wound up at people, but bear in mind she ended up getting the Nobel Prize by the sort of late 80s, 1986, and by that point she'd kind of, you know, sort of like been on good terms with everyone. Mm-hmm. Except there was some controversy, a little bit of controversy there, because essentially some people were saying, oh well, hold on, Hamburger should have gotten some part of this Nobel Prize, and she disagreed, and she publicly explained why he should not have gotten the prize, and it should have just been her and Cohen that got the prize. So people were like, "Oh, that's a little bit that's a little bit self-centered or whatever." And apparently, Hamburger, who lived to 100 years old, apparently he said that their friendship got kind of rocky towards the end because of how she was like acting with he absolutely should not have gotten the Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. And there's
what do you think? Do you think he should have got some Nobel Prize?
I honestly, I don't think I know enough about all the research to really say whether he should have or shouldn't have. But no, I feel like if the Nobel Prize was for the sort of really discovery of what nerve growth factor was, that work was mostly done by Cohen and Levi Montalcini.
Yeah, I'm inclined to trust her judgment on that, seeing as we also know the piece of information you said where she was giving credit to her PhD students and not herself.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I mean,
she's not just taking it all for herself all the time, is she?
No, she's really not. And this is the thing. I just feel like the thing is, like, okay, you, like, where do you stop? Like, who's built on whose work to get there, right? Okay, she built on Hamburger's work, obviously. Hamburger first kind of spotted that there was something, and then she took that and, like, she did the work better. Essentially, what she did quite often, right? Someone would have had an experiment, and then she used that Silverstein technique that she was very good at to be like, this is what's actually going on.
Yeah.
Like, I said this so many times, like, she either like sort of corroborated with someone's hypothesis or corroborated with someone's hypothesis and then built upon it, or sort of disproved their hypothesis and had one of her own and expanded upon that.
Yeah.
So I feel like, from what I know, it seems that her winning the prize just with her and Cohen is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And potentially, maybe if it was, if she were a man, this question would not be coming up. Because
brought up.
Maybe. I don't know. So she also started the European Brain Research Institute in 2002. I think it's still running. It had some rocky times. She was also president of the Italian Multiple Sclerosis Association. Hard sentence to say. And she was a member of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, the first woman to ever be elected into that academy. She also started a project with her sister. I told you her sister, she has a twin sister, who was an artist. Levi Montalcini did so much that I literally could not even mention the cool stuff her family did. so essentially, they essentially sort of mentored teenagers to sort of help them decide whether they want to what they want to do, whether it was science or art, which I think is fantastic and really in line with like this show, right? Like she would have like teenagers come in, she'd be like, this is my research, this is what we've done. I do science. What do you like? Do you want to do art? Do you want to do science? This is what you can do. But yeah, she did a lot of work for I think there's she did a lot of work. I think there's an organization in her name that helped get a lot of women into science. Mm-hmm. And she continued working up until she died. She died in December 2012, 30th mm-hmm. of December 2012. And she published a paper in January 2012. And she was the oldest member of the National Academy of Sciences to publish in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. She was working like for a long time. And if you think she was just doing science up until the time that she died, she was doing more. She was elected, I think it's a governor for life in Italy, where she's obviously from. She died in Rome, as I mentioned at the start.
Yeah.
She was a socialist, as you would be, having fought so much against fascism mm-hmm. throughout your life. And she was friends with a prime minister of, like, sort of left-leaning prime minister. Senator for life. In 2001, she was made. And for 11 years, and she showed up for every parliamentary vote to support that prime minister that she was friends with, sort of coalitions. She just did so much throughout her life, politically, scientifically. She is fantastic. I think someone mentioned, I can't remember who it was. I think someone mentioned her in an email or in a comment or something at some time back. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll have a look. I've never really heard of her. And when I started looking, I said, wow, she's done so much. Yeah. So here is just a quote from her, a couple quotes for her to finish. She said, I'm not afraid of death. I'm privileged to have been able to work for so long. If I die tomorrow or in a year, it is the same. It's the message you leave behind you that counts, and the young scientists who carry on your work. That's aww. Rita Levi-Montalcini. She died in 2012 at 103. Long life, did a lot.
Oh my goodness.
For science, politics, getting people into science. She's just brilliant yeah. scientist. I could honestly do an entire other episode on the stuff that I missed out of this one.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, because we barely touched on the actual science that she did as well. And that's just how great she is. So what do you guys think?
Part two coming soon. Yeah. In the future?
Yeah, when the mini series, like when the streaming series comes out.
When the Netflix series comes out, mm-hmm. that's when we do it. Yeah,
absolutely. Once we're all cast in it, obviously. Netflix, we know.
I'll be happy.
Which one of the men who stood in her way will we all be?
I'll be Mussolini.
You could be Mussolini. Very good. Very good. Look, who would you like to be? Would you like to be?
I will be Hamburger.
Hamburger, okay.
Lovely.
I'll be Cohen, I think. I'll be Cohen. Aww. There we go. Don't know why you chose Mussolini.
That's lovely.
Of all the men in that story, probably one of the worst.
I don't like acting, so I'll just have a brief appearance.
Okay, great. So what do you think, Dr. Rita Levi-Montalcini? She's honestly like really the definition of a scientist, right?
Yeah.
When you think of a lifelong scientist, that's who I think of now. But shall we move on? Shall we finish the show?
Yeah, what's coming up next?
Yeah, well we've got some
important content. Yeah?
A little quick fire quiz. A little quick fire quiz.
Yeah, dun 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 dun.
So the quick fire quiz, as we know, the rules are always the same. I will ask one question and one question only between you. The first person to answer that question correctly wins. And also, I need to finish asking the question before you can buzz in with your answer. I think those are all of the rules. If I'm missing them, look at another episode. They're probably there too. Luke, what is your buzzer? Don't cheat.
Ah!
Okay, Jab, what is your buzzer?
Is that a nerve screaming? What is that?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Sure. What is my buzzer going to be?
Too busy making comments about Luke's buzzer to think of your
own.
Yeah,
man. Stick to your own buzzer. Don't judge mine.
We're just breaking over open an egg to get the embryo.
To get this tasty embryo inside.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Let's go.
Are you both ready for the question?
Yep.
Yeah.
When talking about nerves, what does NGF stand for?
Ah!
Luke.
Nerve growth factor.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct. Well done.
The F does not stand for fuck.
Just before you said it.
I saw you doing your little cracking and I was like, did I just not hear you
make the noise? I forgot what the F was. I was like, what? And then I remember just like the split second before you said it.
Well, there's always next time.
Yeah.
Don't worry too much.
Sorry.
That is it for I'll the show, I think. Well, yeah, you. That is it for the show, I think. Is there anything else you boys want to add?
Little
guys want to add? Huh?
Part two when?
Part two.
Netflix series when?
When Rian Johnson makes a Netflix series, that's when Part two will come out.
Okay.
I love the world we're building.
You better option our podcast before he makes it into a show.
Yeah.
So
we did all the research for you, Rian.
You're welcome.
Well, that is it for this week. But before we go, we would like to have a special thank you to all of our patrons, but a very special thank you to executive producer Ashley Muller, Finn TZ, and Anoni May. And also, thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday, and why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod
@gmail.com. You can follow me at NotCory everywhere.
You can follow me at Champkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
And goodbye.
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 League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.